Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening. This is Tell Me About It with Scroobius Pip and Stuart Whiffin. I am Scroobius Pip, and I'm sat here with...
Stuart Whiffin. I'm already loving the fact that good morning, good afternoon, or good evening feels normal already. And it's only the second time I've heard it.
Oh, man, I can write a catchphrase, I tell you. I've not had to come up with one for... I've been doing the same podcast for 10 years now. I've been dead lazy. You start a new podcast every other month, so you must be knackered.
All I'm ever doing is trying to think of intros for new podcasts.
Well, if this is your first time tuning in, you've missed episode one where we talked about my school days, but that might not be of interest to you. I think it was an interesting one. It's got good feedback on that. Yeah. So, but this one's all about Dan Lesac. And this was one of the first subjects I wrote down. It's, in fact, if you can see my notes on my phone now, it was the first subject I wrote down because the dude's a key part of my life, but in really interesting ways. Because as we'll get into, I knew him prior to any music endeavours of either of us, really. Not necessarily friends at all points along our, our relationship. But man, that dude changed my life completely. So it felt like a natural... It had to be in the first season.
Yeah.
Because it's key. Because he will come up in so many other episodes now. Because like we've got like episodes to come are playing live. Obviously, I did loads of that with Dan.
Yeah.
And divorce. Obviously, my mum left my dad for Dan.
Yeah.
That's not how the divorce song goes. But yeah, he'll come up plenty more. So it felt like a natural place to go. And this was fun for me as well, because you knew Dan as well.
Of course, yeah.
So you knew Dan maybe either before I did or at the same time. He was probably on the peripheral of our friendship groups around the same time. So it's not like he was really in your friendship group. He wasn't in mine at that time.
Yeah.
But we were all aware of him.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I would have met
Dan when he sound
was
weird now.
Probably 16. So I was really looking forward to this one because I imagine, like, you know, I never knew Dan in a sort of working capacity. So it was always just, you know, he was the lad guy in the club.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, he was always about, you know, and in the sort of the gangs of people that would sort of, you know, all sort of turn up to this tiny little club in Basildon. So it was really nice to sort of get a further insight into what it was like being, like, you know, because it's intense for anybody to be in a tour bus, you know, with
particularly
the same
a duo.
Person. Yeah.
But not even any more than that.
It's not
a duo,
like you've got anyone you can go and slag him off to.
No,
like, it's
exactly.
Just you two. Like.
But that's it. It's a good thing you kind of highlight there is the stages of our relationship, because there's, as we'll get into, I'm not giving anything away, but started off as said, just someone, friend of a friend, I guess, was at my college maybe. There was a year or two above me. There was certainly a period where he was a love rival. There was a period where he was a work colleague in retail. Mm. And then there was this whole touring period. And then it was post that.
Yeah.
There's been post me and Dan. So, yeah.
When you said love rat, I was really hoping you were going to say rat. I just thought, I love the
rat.
Thought that Dan Lesac was a 90s love rat.
Love rat. Well, let's get into talking for a good hour or so about Mr. Dan Lesac.
When did you first meet Dan Lesac?
Now, that's an interesting one, because when did I first meet Dan Lesac, or when did I first meet Daniel Stevens, or when I was first exposed to Daniel Stevens?
I think we've all been exposed to Daniel Stevens.
That's the really funny thing, is Dan was a year or two above me at college. I think he went to Palmer's. I'm not sure. No,
he did.
Yeah, did he?
Yeah.
I didn't particularly know him in them days. He had fucking really cool sideburns, big pointy hair. Mm. Huge trousers, I remember, which at that point was cool. In the college days of Palmer's and the amphitheatre and all that. See, I never really felt I knew him in the college days, but as we've alluded to, he used to get his dick out at your club nights quite regularly.
Not just my club nights, just...
Anywhere.
Anywhere.
Yeah. And again, it sounds worse in the Me Too era and the and the current times, but it would be. He'd be drunk and people would encourage it. They'd be like, yep. Get your dick out, Dan. And he'd get his dick out. So I knew him at that point as the lad who gets his dick at the Bullseye.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was my first exposure to him in that respect. But then we worked together at HMV. And again, also another time, I think he was an older cooler kid in my mind. Dan's quite edgy.
He can come across as I've mentioned before, like, you know, I had friends that were not fans of Dan. I've had friends that have punched Dan.
Yeah.
But as mentioned on multiple podcasts, I've always got on really well with him.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think he can, to a lot of people, certainly back then, come across as very overconfident.
Yeah. Yeah. He seemed confident. He seemed edgy and confrontational kind of thing. But again, I quite like that. But equally, that kind of thing, as you say, will rub people up the wrong way.
Yeah.
So I remember in HMV, there were people he didn't like. There was people who didn't like him. My main memory is that when he was leaving HMV, I was the one who sorted out the whip round and picked his present and all this kind of thing. Because again, it's not even that we were that close, but I was like, I think he's fucking cool. He does music and stuff. Even at that point, he did music.
You knew he'd done music then?
Yeah, he did music and he felt like it felt like he knew what he was doing. Again, Dan has always talked on any subject he talks on with great confidence.
Sure.
Whether it's a subject he's an expert on or not. Again, most things he is an expert on. He's an incredibly intelligent lad.
Coming from where we come from, we all have to blag it a bit.
100%. Like we spoke about that in the school days once. I think that was it. I was like, I like him. I think he's funny. I think anything he said that people have got offended by, I found quite funny. I've not found offensive. So yeah, I liked him. I thought he was a cool lad.
And when he was leaving HMV, was that to move to Reading?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. He was moving to Reading to go to college, I assume.
And so Reading to Stamford, where you was, to give that some sort of context as well, that's a good couple of hours drive, isn't it?
Oh yeah. 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 By all expectations, that was the end of our interactions.
Sure.
Do you know what I mean? Like, we weren't close enough to be, oh, we're going to be friends forever kind of thing. Yeah.
So was you already writing sort of poetry, unstructured verse, what, you know, spoken word? Had you done any spoken word at this point?
I was writing diss tracks.
What's that mean?
just offensive raps about people.
Oh, diss raps. Sorry, diss raps, I thought you said diss tracks. I thought, what's that?
So me, 76, mm-hmm. Mutt 3000. Mm-hmm. And sometimes Dan would just write stuff on the tills at HMV, just being dicks. Like, so we'd pick a member of staff or each other. Again, no one was off bounds, and we'd write just offensive raps about him, or just diss raps. And we were going to be like, oh, we're going to call ourselves the Ridiculous MCs, and Dan was going to be part of that. He was like, I'll make the beats and all this, and it was all just absolute nonsense.
Have you heard anything you've done at that point?
I must have heard bits, yeah. I don't know where I would have. I guess he would have bought a CD or something. And it might just be more just aware that he's doing it. Mm. And again, that illusion, that mystique of someone who knows how to do stuff. So yeah, obviously, a Ridiculous MCs never came to anything. Although, 76 ended up becoming a wicked producer. Mm. Weirdly, out of me, Mutt, and 76, Mutt was the one who bought like a keyboard for looping and sampling, all that kind of thing. I left it under his bed and never took it out of the box. But yeah, so I guess I was the one that kind of kept writing there and got more serious on it. And yeah, at some point that Dan had left and I started working on No Commercial Breaks.
Okay.
So other HMV people, again, it's mad. Like, we could do a whole episode on HMV. It's mad how important HMV was, because two other people I worked with at HMV, Ross Lawson and Alan Shultis. Alan was a really good drummer in loads of bands. I think one of the bands he was in beat up your mate Cunt at a gig for... No, was it Cunt or one of your other mates' bands who did? It was one of your comedy band's mates, and they got in a fight at a gig at Rayleigh. Oh, was it Justin? Of course it was. Of course it was. It was Justin. That's it. I remember hearing him tell that story on one of the things. I was like, I think that was my mates who did that. But yes, so Alan was in a band that were really influenced by Tool. So yeah. It was all quite technical and yeah. all quite really like they're all real musos. And Ross was just a multi-instrumentalist. Mm. He ran the jazz and world music section. Yes, and he played sax, guitar, keys, bass, a bit of drums. He played everything. So when I was writing No Commercial Breaks, I kind of wrote most of the tracks on just, I had some CDJs and a recording desk. So I'd loop samples, build the tracks and do the demos. And then when we got studio time, I got those guys to come in the studio with me and replay everything and hopefully change it enough to not get yeah. done for sample infringement. Thankfully, I only ever made a 1,000 copies. So it's not like any infringement would make anyone rich. But so yeah, I'd made that. And then when I was quitting my job after recording it to go to do a thing I called the Relying on the Kindness of Strangers tour. And the idea was I get in a van, I had a space cruiser. Chris came with me for loads of it. Mm-hmm. And the idea was I'm going to tour around the country and just turn up and play on street corners, try and find open mics. But I sent a few of the flyers out to anyone I knew in places. So my mate Alex was at uni in Norwich. So I sent her some to kind of leave about. Because the flyer I made said, if you've got a night, if you've got anything, or if you can help in any way, just hit me up on my MySpace. Bang. I sent one to Dan and he hit me up going, I'm running a night or I'm putting on a gig with Nathan Fake and Vincent Oliver and all these really good artists. He's like, do you want to, I think I essentially opened, I was on very early.
In Reading
at the Fez Club.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I toured about a bit and then I got back there and that's where we kind of re-met.
And what was a live show for Pip at that point? What was the kind of setup?
Oh mate, it was too much. So it was me with, I had options. So the bare minimum is me on a street corner, either with the beats I had made on a tape
yeah.
in a ghetto blaster mm-hmm. or a little battery powered amp and a loop pedal. So I'd beatbox into a loop pedal, build up the track and then rap over the top.
Okay.
A lot of the early demos were all made like that. So I'd kind of written them as just beatboxing loops and then I go over the top. And this was a real basic one. It wasn't like you see
yeah.
Blind Boy or Ed Sheeran or whoever else with where you can
sure.
bring things in and out. It's you press it, you stop it. It's looping that. At any point you press it again, you can add to it, mm-hmm. but it's looping. So that was the bare minimum. The full show was having a CD player. I had a projector with slides, a proper old slide yeah. projector. So I had particular slides for each song. I like when I wrap the periodic table. No, I had a fold out periodic table actually. Yeah. So I had that. So it was quite, I'd planned it all out. I'd put in a lot of work to kind of go, because my initial plan was I want to go in my van and go up north and make them think I must be big down south because I had my look, I had my suit and my trucker cap and my big beard. I was beatboxing in my loop pedal. A few of the songs I was beatboxing and playing harmonica in the loop pedal and then rapping over the top. I had a slide, a projection show, all these things to kind of feel like, oh, this is a full show. So the first one I ever did indoors with the projection, I think, was for Dan at the Fez
right.
in Reading. So that was my first ever actual gig. Everything other than that was like in Derby at one point, I was just performing on a table outside a pub and they came in and said, get off our table. But like we've got a house band on tonight. If you want to come and do something with them, you can. So none of them were proper gigs. And that was the first one that, yeah.
Felt like a proper gig.
Yeah, that Dan had asked me to do. I was on the lineup. I'd been booked. And then when Dan did his set.
What was Dan doing?
He was doing like he did with me and Dan. It's like live off his laptop,
mm-hmm.
probably some sample triggers, all this kind of thing, a keyboard. So it was a DJ set as such, but far more live and improvised. Yeah, I loved it. It blew me away. And then halfway through, he dropped a remix of one of my tracks. And then he dropped a few of them in this.
Did you know
so I'd sent him the CD. I didn't. I'd sent him the CD and he'd cut some bits up and put them in there. And it blew me away. It was like, this is amazing. And that's why we started our MySpace page. Because it was just to hold his remixes, essentially. Dan Lesac versus Scroobius Pip was never planned out as a band, as an act. It was just, oh, your remixes are dope. We've both got our own MySpace pages. And I think we maybe had put one up on each and they were by far more popular than anything else that we had on our pages. So Yeah, we did a bespoke one of me and Dan.
So there was no actual conversation ahead of that about collaborative work?
No.
He just done a remix for you?
There never was any conversation about a collaborative work. For a long time, it was just, we're doing a bit of a side thing, but we're both doing our solo stuff still. We both see ourselves as solo artists. And then it just all, it grew and grew and grew.
Well, I don't want to sort of fast track too much on that because I want to know how it started to grow. Was there a conversation about, look, I've got these beats, you've got these lyrics, you know, should we start doing some more stuff together?
Even more organic than that, really. He gave me his album, Le Sax Say Yeah, and there was a track on that. I was like, I love this. And I had a song called At All, and he had this particular track was called A Rapper's Battle, and I rapped At All over it. Again, he hadn't asked me to. I was just like, this fits perfectly. And that became Rapper's B. No, his, I can't remember which one it was. No, his was called Rapper's B and mine was called At All. And we had a song called Rapper's Battle because I put them together. And the first one that we did a collaboration really was Thou Shout. He sent me the beat and I was like, all right, I've got an idea for this.
So tell me what you thought then, other than I've got an idea, or was it just as simple as I've got an idea for this, the first time you heard the music to Thou Shout?
I'd been doing that spoken word piece at spoken word gigs because it was really handy as to personalise because you can add a commandment at the drop of a hat. Mm-hmm. Thou shalt not attend an open mic and leave as soon as you've done your shitty little poem or song, you self-righteous prick, came because I went after a guy at an open mic who'd been waiting the whole time, did a fucking shit translation. It wasn't even he'd translated it from Latin, and then he literally came off the stage and walked out. It was a gig at the Poetry Cafe. Was it New Blood? It was by a guy called Niall O'Sullivan, who did amazing nights there, still does amazing things. And I added that line in that night because that happened, and it went off. It got a huge reaction because everyone had clearly noticed that this guy had been hassling as well. It was like, when can I go up? I'd like to go up soon. And they'd be like, you'll go up when it's your turn, kind of thing.
So,
having a track that you could just adapt to what's going on in the news that day or literally in the room that moment.
But Dan heard perfect. This before. No,
he hadn't.
Can you remember the first time you put that to music? And tell me about that process. You know, so much of your working relationship, we'll get onto it a bit later, but initially with Thou Shalt, was it another, he sent you the beat, right, I'm going to record it my end, or did you go into a studio together, or...
He sent me the beat, and this became an issue down the line because he'll send me a beat, I'll love it, and record and send it back, and it'll be done. And he's like, that was like an idea. Like, that was a sketch of a beat. Yeah. You're not meant, I was just saying what you think. He learned to only send me stuff that he felt was in some way finished because I'd just be like, this is amazing. So he sent me the beat for Thou Shalt. I loved it. I went upstairs immediately and started recording it in my bedroom at my mum's house. So I had three mattresses at that point on the floor, because I was a little punk kid.
Yeah.
And I'd make a little studio with that. So I'd do my three mattresses. I'd put a towel over the top. I had a step ladder, not my real ladder, that I taped a microphone to as a mic stand. And that's where I recorded Thou Shalt. I came up with the Just a Band bit kind of in the moment.
Yeah.
I emailed it back to him. And we can, if I go on my phone now, I can get the exact amount of time that took because he emailed that to me. And then he put on the film 40-Year-Old Virgin. And when it finished, I emailed him back with what became the first version of Thou Shalt that got uploaded on the MySpace and got loads of listens and all that kind of thing.
I mean, that's DIY as fuck.
Proper DIY.
And I mean, financially, that's a pretty cheap record, isn't it?
It's a really cheap record. But also, it's a record that you don't realise anyone's ever going to hear.
Yeah.
Like, I've heard that certain people in Hollyoaks got quite offended by that. And I don't want to offend anyone in Hollyoaks. Yeah. It worked at the time because my mum was really into Hollyoaks.
Yeah.
But it was on so regularly that if she needed to catch up and she had like a week's worth, she'd watch it on fast forward to get the idea and then move on to the next episode, which kind of said as much as it needed to me about the artistic value of it at the time.
Yeah, but essentially Dan and Pip are just a band as well, aren't they?
Yeah. So we were just, we were dicking about, and there's loads of stuff in that people are like, oh, yeah, but It's always made me uncomfortable when people are like, oh, I live by that. It's like, oh, you shouldn't, mate. It took me, not a lot of thought went into it. And also the fact that I put some intentional contradictions in there, because the last line, I mean, the easiest one is that it's a 3-minute song telling you what to do. And then the last line is thou shalt think for yourselves.
Yeah.
So that should give you a clue that it's meant to be kind of contradicting. But I remember like when it blew up, we had some reviewers like, oh, fucking, you start by praising Johnny Cash and these people and then say you shouldn't put bands on pedestals and so on and so forth. And it's like, yeah, all right. Or that was the one, thou shalt not think guns, bitches and bling are part of the four elements or whatever the line is. I don't know the line anymore. And then someone would be like, yeah, but Johnny Cash always used to talk about guns. So, yeah, all right. Yeah, you got me. I'll have to delete the song now. Yeah, it was so throwaway and in the moment, and then obviously it changed absolutely everything.
Were you aware that you know, both of you had created something a bit special?
Not really. It was working at poetry nights.
Yeah.
Like at that point, my normal poetry set was Thou Shalt, Angles, and Letter from God to Man.
Okay,
solid which now looking back is like this amazing this hit set. And yeah, they were working in that context, but didn't know how they'd work on record as such. And again, particularly with Thou Shalt being the one that blew up, you couldn't have predicted it in any way. It's why we didn't have anyone, I don't know, yeah, it's why we came out of nowhere, because no one would expect a 3.5 minute song that's got probably a minute long outro,
yeah,
at least, hasn't got a chorus or verses.
Yeah.
It's just a rant. It's got the Just a Band bit, but that only happens once, so I guess it's not a chorus, really. It didn't have anything that would suggest radio will go for this or
completely. The
public will go for this. So it was me sending a CDR of it to John Kennedy, him playing it that night, and it becoming like one of the most requested songs or inquired about songs on his show's history. But again, even that, it's a warped perception. The reason it was the most inquired about was because no one knew where the fuck we were. Like, we literally hadn't been played anywhere. So it's not like The Strokes. You have a Strokes song and it was like, oh yeah, I love The Strokes. Thou Shalt comes on and you're like, who and what and where?
Yeah.
How has this happened?
Yeah.
Because it was just in my bedroom at my mum's.
When it did explode like that, and it did feel, as somebody that knew Dan, and obviously I knew he was, we'd seen each other around, mm-hmm. you know, you'd been to the clubs and stuff.
Yeah, you didn't like me.
No. and it did explode.
Yeah.
What sort of conversations were you and Dan having at this point? Like, were there like, what the fuck conversations?
Just exciting. It was like, this is cool. Like, we had labels to talk to, we had managers to talk to, and we had all sorts of stuff. And there wasn't a lot of thought or conversation that goes into it. I think the interesting part, I guess, is we were suddenly thrown into a partnership hadn't really thought about. And I think all through our relationship, there's been points, as again, you'll talk to any band who's toured together a lot, there'll be points of real conflict. And I think that was an interesting and daunting, like it was kind of ever present. Again, like we spoke on the, I don't know in what order these will go out, but we spoke about me being a laid back person.
Yeah.
I think that helped a lot because Dan was at times quite confrontational.
Sure.
And there was a period where we'd do interviews, but yeah, because Thou Shalt had blown up. And there was a period where we'd do interviews about how we met and we'd do a thing of making up stories. So Dan would say that his mum gave my mum a kidney. Mm-hmm. And we met in at the hospital. But then there was times he'd kind of drift some truth in there and he'd kind of say, well, we'd kind of known of each other over the years. There were some points where there was some possible crossover with girlfriends. And there was always a lot of hinting at he'd slept with at least one or two people that I'd been going out with while I was going out with them. But I'm someone, again, who's like, all in the past, but let's not get into it because it'll eat me up or it'll cause tension.
Yeah.
So I'm still not 100% sure how much of that is true, how much was implied. But again, it was part of Dan's confrontationalness and edginess. And
you've got no one else because essentially bands, when you experience this for the first time and it's all, like you say, management, looking for labels and they're coming looking for you at this point. when you're a band, there's normally four or five of you out, and you can, if that guy's pissing you off, go and hang out with the other one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just you two.
Yeah.
And so that's intense and like
hugely intense.
And we'll talk about ego and success and things like that a little bit further down the line, but would you lean on each other in those early moments, like of it starting to, you know, yeah, the hype happening?
100%. Again, what you've got to remember is I came into this as a Dan Lessac fan.
Yeah.
You know, I loved his Lessac A Year album. He was very much someone I was excited to work with and looked up to. And then we got to do all these amazing things together. So now I had kind of a new power as such.
Yeah.
Like it was someone I'd known from around the way, yeah, but we're suddenly touring together and having...
We got thrust together
as
well.
Amazing times, yeah. And like, it was, again, I felt, again, I don't want that to sound as if it's a negative. I felt incredibly lucky to be thrust together because
sure,
he is fucking good at what he does. And we had amazing times. Like, although I said there was probably some tensions and confusion and not sure, 99%, particularly in those early days, yeah, was just, how cool is this? Like, we're getting to go out and party and do gigs and
but that's
blowing
every
up.
Friendship, relationship, working environment. That's just part of it.
Yeah.
You spoke about doing amazing things. What was the first real wow moment when the hype kicked for you and Dan that you remember experiencing together?
I'll give a couple here because initially, just any gig, like the first couple of gigs we did as Dan Lessac versus Scroobius Pip.
Where would I?
So in Reading, I remember we did one with Clark. You familiar with Clark, the producer guy? I think he might have been on Warp at the time, but it's like a glitchy producer guy, really good. And we played with him again. It was the early gigs was stuff that just either Dan's mates were putting on or he was putting on in Reading. It was in like it was fucking creepy. It was a venue that was in like an industrial estate kind of thing. So you just go in the dark to this, was it the Box or something like that? And yeah, we did a gig and we'd never really practiced together. Like we'd practice separately in my car beforehand. We were kind of going over it all and planning it all. And because I had stuff from the spoken word gigs, so for Angles, I'd always change costumes, and for Thou Shalt, I'd have the big book. I had that stuff. Or maybe I got it for me and Dan, but either way I'd prepped so we'd have a bit of a show. And I remember the first, I don't know if that was our first gig, but that's the one I remember of going, oh wow, that, like, it worked.
Yeah,
we did it and people liked it. Some people knew a few of the songs,
yeah,
and we had a handful of songs at that point, so that was one that was like, it's just fucking easy.
Yeah.
we've never practiced. This is probably our first ever gig and we've got adoring fans.
Yeah.
It's all going off. So that stands out massively. But then the first time we did the Camden Crawl and we were doing, not the Underworld, the Camden...
Forum?
The Barfly.
Barfly.
We're doing the Barfly and we're upstairs and we look out. And the Camden Crawl is one of them ones where you don't buy a ticket. You've got a wristband. So people just queue up and the amount of people who can get in. And we looked out and we had a queue around the block. We were like, oh, shit. This is cool. And then, yeah, it was at absolute capacity.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it felt as if this is going somewhere.
Well, I guess I've worked with you over various projects and bits and pieces for probably 12 years. And I know for a fact that you're a very laid back, calm person.
Yeah.
Tell me about how you would deal with those early moments where there was disagreements. You know, was there any disagreements or heat, you know, more heated arguments in the, and I'm not fishing for gossip, but no, like in those early sort of moments on the back of the success of Thou Shalt, like, was there any moments where you just thought, oh, this is getting awkward?
There were and there weren't, okay. You know, as I said, because of my laid back nature, 99% of the time, I ain't looking to argue.
Sure.
If Dan wants to do something a specific way, I'll say that I think maybe we should do this or maybe we should go there.
Was you always comfortable like approaching him then on the strength of like if a beat come through that you weren't feeling? Was it always an open enough relationship
to go,
I'm not feeling that one?
Completely.
And vice versa?
Completely. He'd fire me a load of stuff. Like he'd slave over like 12 beats and I'd come back with one going, I love this beat, and not thinking to say, how about the rest of it?
Yeah.
Like, it's probably heartbreaking. But and equally, he was really amicable on things like Fixed and Letter From God to Man. I had specific ideas in mind for the beat because Fixed is Fix Up Look Sharp. It's kind of a cover. Mm-hmm. And Letter From God to Man, I had that Radiohead sample in mind as being the thing. So Dan isn't really a sampling guy.
Mm.
He's a create his own stuff. So, but particularly A Letter From God To Man, look at what he did with that.
Yeah.
like that's one of the best.
Incredible.
Beat-wise and track-wise, it's one of his best bits of work. So, yeah, it was always all good on that. And, yeah, I think there wasn't a lot of conflict in those early days, you know, because it was just, this is mad that this is happening. Like, we're getting to do this, particularly Dan as someone who'd been slaving at stuff for far longer than me, yep, with mixed levels of reaction. To suddenly have something that felt quite easy to both of us.
Yeah.
Like, we've not got tons of unused ideas and demos. Yeah. We kind of would go, you got a beat, all right, I've got a lyric. Right, there's another one. And that was our albums. Or for me anyway, I didn't have loads of unused ideas.
And, you know, I want to talk about signing to Sunday Best. Mm-hmm. But ahead of that, you don't have to answer this if you don't want to. Tell me about the financials. Was it something that was agreed that it would be 50-50?
Yeah, pretty much. That was the outlook from the start, I think.
Yeah.
I always knew on the financial side, Dan was taking a far bigger risk than me. I'd quit my job. I was doing this. He had a good, well-paid job in, like, I'm sure it was in marketing or advertising. He was doing a graphic design and stuff. So it was a bigger deal for him to go, yeah, right, well, this is our life now. Because I was like, well, I ain't got nothing else.
Yeah.
I'm living in a van or at my mum's house. So, yeah. but yeah, that was always agreed. I remember we had one meeting. We almost signed to XL when they had Jack and Adele, because we did a lot of gigs with Jack Peñate, Adele, a lot of that crowd.
I want to do another episode where we talk
about the scene
and, yeah, those early gigs.
There's some amazing people in there.
Were floating about then, because it's quite a list.
But yeah, because of all of that, we were in with XL and they kind of asked, Richard Russell was like, Adele is Adele. She's working with other people, but Adele is Adele and Jack is Jack. Would you be okay with it being Scroobius Pip rather than Dan Lissac versus Scroobius Pip?
Question. That was literally my next question. Was there talk of that? So there was.
That's what he asked. And
based on you being the front man?
Yeah, on me being the front man, and again, it being easier. It's a long, unwieldy name. It's our band name is a sentence. It's a lot. And he said the producer just generally isn't listed in the...
Sorry, so it was just you'd perform as a duo as Scroobius Pip, not as Scroobius Pip versus Dan Lissac.
No. That's what he was asking. So we'd do the album as Scroobius Pip. It'd be produced by Dan Lissac.
Oh, okay.
Again, his argument was, look at the history of hip-hop.
Yeah.
Jay-Z has an album. It's produced by someone amazing.
Yeah.
And all this. It's like, that was his... And again, his examples were Adele and Jack Peñate, who were blowing up at the time. It's like, Jack's got a whole band. Adele obviously can do it all acoustic, but it's got producers, all it sorts was, of stuff.
Yeah.
And he said examples of rap. It's generally the rapper is who the album is by, and the producer is in there, is getting their cut and their praise. And this is all being said in his office.
How, like, do you feel that?
Thrown at us. It felt weird. And then I looked over his head and he had a big framed poster of Eric B and Rakim.
There you go.
And I went, just kind of pointed at that. I was like, Eric B and Rakim, it doesn't make a difference. It's not about that. But we did have go away and have a think about it and have a chat. And we decided that we wanted it to be Dan Lissac versus Scroobius Pip. That's what we'd gone with. Again, a large part of that was, I keep going back to it, but I approached this as just a Dan Lissac fan.
Sure.
So the fact I'm getting to go on with him,
yeah,
despite me being the front man or whatever, yeah, now, it's very much a collaboration. But yeah, we had a conversation about it and we decided to stand our ground. I think XL pulled out their interest before we had to make a hard decision on it.
Oh, okay.
I think they moved on and said, no, we're not going to go with it. So I don't think we had to go. But again, everything that we discussed was like, no, this is what it is. It's a 50-50 collaboration. And again, I think we'll get in later on. I think that stuff, me being at the front, did cause conflict.
Yeah.
That, down the line. But yeah, we'll get onto all that, I'm sure.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
One of the other things that, correct me if I'm wrong, but it felt like you took a bit more of a creative lead on was the videos.
Yeah.
So what kind of discussions were you and Dan having in regards to you potentially co-directing, can we say that? I'll be more involved.
Yeah, 100%. Again, it was all, there weren't big discussions. It was just, particularly as I'd written the lyrics, I'm quite a visual person. So I'd say, oh, I've got this idea. Like, Thou Shalt was all Nick Frew, amazing director. I might have thrown in a few ideas, but he came up with all of it. And then the more he did, the more I was like, here's my idea for this one. Here's what I think we should do. So the beat of my heart skipped and things like that. And A Look for the Woman was, again, mostly his idea, but then I'd throw things in. And Nick kind of took me aside and said, look, you should direct some videos at some point because you're coming up with,
yeah,
or you're wanting to have a lot of input. And in a friendly way, it wasn't in a leave me to do my art. It was like, you're clearly excited about this and have a lot of ideas and a lot to say. But yeah, I think that did, again, that hit a wall. I would say the biggest period of conflict, and again, there wasn't even any big stories or gossip to tell.
I'm not searching for one because you're my friends.
Yeah, but no, again, it's worth, I think it's all good to talk about and discuss. I think I would say the biggest period of conflict was around our second album. And at that point, Dan and our manager at the time both said, look, we're blowing up. I think we should get other people to take the lead on the videos now, and that I should step back a bit on that. And again, I was like, all right, cool. Like, I don't know what I'm doing. I've never done this, so completely understand that. And then that turned round again on the last album, because in between I directed or co-directed all my solo ones, and they'd gone down well. So yeah,
I want to sort of wind it back just a little bit more, and just on that first tour, like that first sort of proper tour. Did you have any sort of, or did excitement overall everything, or did you have apprehensions about, okay, so I've now got to get in a van with this guy that I don't necessarily know really well and travel around the country with him? And you know, what apprehensions did you have at that point?
I think at that point, excitement overruled everything. Because again, it's like, I'm getting to do, I'm not having to work in an office. I'm getting to go and do music.
It's essentially like going on holiday with your girlfriend for the first time, isn't it? Are we going to get through this fortnight?
And again, at that point, a lot of those early years, they weren't proper tours. It was like, we'll drive here and then we'll drive home the same night, or we'll do a couple of things here and things like that. So yeah, I wouldn't say there was anything. Just caught up in the excitement of the hype over Thou Shalt, and then the album coming out, and the excitement of Thou Shalt not being a flash in the pan. And in my opinion, not even being the best song on the record, like, because that was it. A song like that comes out of nowhere. It's got novelty written all over it, 100%. Because it was so unlike anything else. It's why we took our time on the album, despite having all sorts of offers kind of thrown at us. And it's why, as you, I mean, you said we're going to get to it. It's why we ended up on Sunday Best, because we were talking to EMI, to Sony, to Warner, to loads of big labels, and we were getting advice off Rob the Bank at points to say, here's what they've put in the contract, or here's what they're offering. Is that good or bad? Because Rob had played us on the radio and had put on some gigs and asked us to play, and we felt we trusted him. And it felt like Sunday Best were up for us making our record and then them releasing it, whereas a few of the others seemed like they were like, here's what we see for you. here's where we think you should go. But not as simple as that either. Again, my clearest memories was thinking all the indie labels we're going to meet are going to get it and all the majors aren't.
Yeah.
And when we sat down with a guy, was it Sony or Universal? I can't remember. It was a publishing one. And he got all the references, all the background stuff on all the different tracks that at that point with demos and stuff like that. Yeah. So it's not like he'd just Googled it and gone, all right, I'll try and impress them. He really got it. So that was a weird time. I remember being in with the head of Warner and we'd arranged, like we'd been talking to him back and forth for a bit. And we said, look, before we agree to anything, like we want to meet the main man, like to see that this is being taken seriously. Because the fear of majors, as we saw with numerous people in the scene, like Kate Nash and others, the fear of majors is they grab you and then you get swallowed up in their long list of priorities. And he sat us down and we had this good meet. And the first thing that got me was he said, you guys into Linkin Park? I was like, not so much, man. But again, he saw some elements of Linkin Park in what we do, which was, all right, well, I don't, but all right. And then we had that meeting and then I went home. I'm sure it was that same night. And the, whose documentary was it? There was a documentary of a boy band reuniting. Was it Five, maybe?
There was a massive Take That one.
No, it wasn't.
And then
there
was an E17 one. E17.
It might have been the E17 one. It was the documentary of one of the boy bands and they were in his office.
E17 one.
And he was saying, like, you're the best thing. And it's like, it felt like this was exactly the stuff he was saying to us. And with the greatest respect, we're nothing like E17. Mm. So yeah, that made us go, nah, this ain't the one. Again, tons of money on the table. At that point, labels were offering over 100 grand. It was just when Hadouken had just got that big deal for like $500,000 or some shit. And we were in that kind of group as well, with your Hadoukens and your Does It Offend You? Yeah, and all that kind of crowd. So yeah, there was a lot of money being talked about. And again, we had to take that into consideration because as I said, Dan was walking away from a full-time job. Sure. I could be the artist and go, let's go with this. But it's like, no, we have to talk about this correctly. So yeah, we did. And we decided that Sunday Best were the best place for us because they were really wanted to let us make our record and then, you know, push it as best they can.
That first tour, did you feel like you've got to know each other on that?
Yeah, and Soundman Jim.
Yep. I have to remember there was three in the van, wasn't there? Yep. Someone's got to drive.
Yeah, so Jim, and on that tour, I'd say Dan put up with a lot in those days of just my artistic ideas. I'd be like, I think we should have like a living room on stage.
Yeah.
And we went to charity shops and bought a load of furniture and made a living room on stage.
Well, let's talk a little about that then, because when you go on tour and you're doing these shows every night, there's so many things that are in the mix of that. There's ego, there's pressure, there's drinking, there's sleep, there's routine. Mm-hmm. They're all ingredients to test every possible partnership.
Mm-hmm.
What were the most testing for you? And what do you think were the most testing for Dan?
I think what became testing for Dan, more when the album came out, I think, was, as you say, if there's a 6'4" bearded bloke at the front, that's going to take your attention a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I was really aware of that. I'd make sure, as an example, and letter from God to man, I'd always either be off stage or sit at the side of the stage when Dan's doing his thing. Because it was like, as someone from around here, Bulldog made a trend at the time of just tweeting and saying he's playing a football manager because he'd be on stage with his laptop and he's doing so much. So I'd consciously want to make sure people can tell that Dan's doing everything.
Yeah.
And again, I think that maybe played on his mind a bit. I think at times he made it harder for himself than he had to, like setup wise, because he wanted to prove he was doing shit because he's not got some decks back there. So if you've not got decks, people will just think, oh, he's pressing play.
Sure.
And he wasn't. He was doing so much stuff there. So I think that maybe played into it. Alcohol, definitely. Again, both of us would drink a fair bit because of nerves initially, I think. The schedule as well. Like, we were just any gig that came in. Yep, 100%. Like, we wanted to get really good really quick. And I think we did that. I think we achieved that.
That's the only way you do that as well.
Yeah, we gigged constantly. Small gigs, big gigs. In my van, in the van, with Soundman Jim, however it works, we were up for it. Dan started that period in a bad relationship as well, so that probably didn't help things. Yep. it didn't end that relationship in the best way, but that was down to drink and ego and other things as well played into that. But then he was in a good relationship for a period at least. So, yeah, that was all good. So, yeah, I guess all those things can play into it. But on the UK period of this, it was just a dream, in my opinion. We're living our dream. Like, we're getting to do these gigs that everyone's just going crazy for. I'd only done maybe 3 gigs before becoming Scroobius Pips, so in other bands as a bassist.
Yeah.
And I'd had the ups and downs of just being absolute heaven to absolute dog shit. So, it was a dream. It wasn't until the American tour that I feel that got really testing. Because again, as you say, it's only the two of us. You're going to have a tour manager you've not met. You're away from all your friends and family. Yeah, and there were points on that tour where things got tense and it felt like... But again, I think that was off the back of I was getting an awful lot of praise from my lyrics. Largely, Thou Shalt and Let From God to Man, we're getting a lot of praise lyrically. And anyone who pays any attention will know that the production on both of those tracks is fucking key to how, particularly on Let From God to Man, to how grand it all sounds. That's so much down to Dan. But if you're writing a quick article or whatever else, it's going to be about this track about God.
Yeah.
So I think that started to play on Dan's mind a bit.
Let's not take emphasis off the fact that it should be written about as well, because it is, the lyrics are amazing. I'm not just saying that you're sitting opposite me, but it's good stuff.
Yeah. It worked. But yeah, that was the weird thing of, I guess that may be an issue then, the fact that these are lyrics that were written to stand up on their own. Because these were all spoken word pieces. So the production is going to elevate it, but they're going to stand up on their own as well. So that's going to be where it might be a bit more confusing. But yeah, I'm trying to think of when the tour of America was. I think it was on the first album still. But yeah, we really started to have conflict there. And it was always, again, because we get on, it was always kind of more passive aggressive, you know? And I remember the one time we kind of talked about it, we were playing somewhere or other, we'd had a nightmare. Dan had sacked our tour manager because they'd butted heads too much. So we're in the middle of this tour. Thank God for B. Dolan, who we'd met on that tour. He was our support act. We'd never met him before. He was part of the Strange Famous family. He could take over on the drive-in because he had a license out there, all this kind of thing. But yeah, we're having a bit of a nightmare. So there were some kind of crunch talks going on between Sage and the label and me and Dan. And Dan replied to one of them in a passive-aggressive kind of snarky way. And at that point, I just went into the room. Like, we were in separate rooms or whatever, and I went and said, like what's good kind of thing? Like, is there an issue? Because again, it's, as you know, all of those things, if they're left under the surface, it's going to be a nightmare. But yeah, I remember hating that tour. And again, not particularly because of Dan, just because of everything that was going on. It wasn't good. Again, Dan didn't help.
Yeah.
but I'm not saying it was purely a Dan thing, but I wrote, and I've got it somewhere, I wrote a draft of an email retiring and quitting. I literally typed it all out saying the guilt I felt that I was out here living the dream that all my mates who still work in HMV or wherever else would love to be doing, and I'm miserable.
Do you think Dan was the same?
I think so. I think there was some issues there. Again, it's tough. It's hard. I can't tell Dan's story as such. Sure. So I'm sure there were some conflict and issues. As I said, that what we've talked about since is that there was I've always said, I don't think I've ever said it to Dan. I think that whilst we didn't necessarily personally fall out much, I think going into the second album, I was as big a Dan Lesac fan as I'd ever been, because he's fucking killed the first album. The beats he was making for this were amazing. And I think going into the second album, he wasn't particularly a Scroobius Pip fan at that point. That was just the personal vibe I got. I felt, and again, it could be oversensitivity to maybe some ideas I put forward that got knocked back or whatever, but that was the vibe I got going into that album. Whereas on the last album, I Repent, it felt as if we'd both got back to being just fans of each other.
Well, before we get to that album,
yes,
in between that, you both released solo records.
Yeah.
So what was the discussions? Was that something that come off the back of it had been a testing tour and you know, like, where do I go with this?
It's a weird one, you know, because again, it goes back to also the fact that we never had a discussion about being a band, really. It just kind of all happened and continued on. And I had stuff I wanted to do. Again, as we talked about in the school issue, I wanted to do stuff that was a bit hard and punky. Yeah. And punky, that sounds so shit. It's a bit punky.
It's a bit punky.
All right, you're punky. Basically, essentially, at that point, I'd had a few different ideas of directions of tracks I wanted to do that Dan wasn't into.
Yeah.
And that was absolutely fair enough. I think also, yeah, Dan had done a record with this girl called Kid A, mm-hmm. who came on tour, who's sung on a second record as well. They'd done a record together, which I thought was fantastic. And again, it was that realisation that we were getting more and more, as we've discussed on Drunkcasts and stuff, it's so weird that I ended up doing music that could come under the dance mm-hmm. category in some festivals, mm-hmm. like we'd be in dance tents sometimes, because dance was the one genre as a kid I could not get into at all.
Yeah.
Like Dan Lesac was my introduction to dance music. Yeah. It wasn't the Chemical Brothers, sure. or whoever else. It was going, oh, I like what he does. Is that dance? All right, well, I'm into that. So yeah, I think the second album went even more in that direction, which again was fine and I loved it, but I was like, I want to do something that's more the music I'm properly into.
Yeah.
So yeah, I started hitting people. I mentioned it to Dan. I said, "There's like, I'd sent a few things that he wasn't into. I was like, oh, I might make these as a little, like, I might do an EP or whatever else. And then, yeah, in that period, it was off the back of that, of touring. And I think we did tour our asses off and probably needed a break from touring in general, but also from each other, I guess. Sure. And yeah, I made the solo record expecting it to be a little fling this out and then get back to the real job.
Yeah.
The day job with Dan. And it went down, it blew up. So yeah. That kind of, but again, I'm pretty sure as soon as that album was out and I was touring, me and Dan were still going back and forth on beats and tracks and yeah. stuff like that. And he was working on his solo record, Space Between the Words.
So you come back and make a third record.
Yeah.
Commercially, the most successful as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Not many bands get to do that. That's incredible.
Madness, isn't it?
When you're having the conversations post-solo records, I know you said that you were still kind of throwing beats to each other and you decide to make another record. Was it ever discussed that it was going to be the last?
It must have been. We'd originally done a three-album deal and essentially at that point, no one who we'd come up with, like everyone would get a three-album deal. No one who we'd come up with had got to do three albums. Yeah. Kate had been dropped by a label. Adele releases in big gaps, as we've seen, because she's arguably one of the greatest artists in British history. So fair play to her. Jack had done like two albums and then changed his direction and what he wanted to do completely. So yeah, I think it was just exciting to go, oh, we're going to get to complete our record deal, because that doesn't happen a lot. Yeah. But at some point, we must have discussed it, because I know on the tours and everything, it was all established and announced that this was it, at least for now. I'd decided I was done with it.
Done with music?
Yeah, for the time being, at least. When you tour a lot, you meet a lot of bands, and I'd met a lot of bands who didn't really enjoy it anymore, and I really enjoyed the gigs. Again, I didn't enjoy all of the touring. Sometimes it was a nightmare, but I enjoyed all the gigs. And I was like, I don't want to get to the point where I don't enjoy them anymore. I'd rather draw a line underneath it. And again, I'd say, yeah, initially it was, I thought it'd probably be a year or two and then I'd maybe come back. I wanted to break the cycle. You get in the habit. And again, it feels as if I'm shitting on our second album. There's loads of songs on that I really like, yeah. But it felt like there was that process of you do the album, you tour it, you got a festival season, you maybe tour it again, and then you need the next album, tour it. And mm-hmm. it's, you know, it's a cycle. And I was like, I want to write because, and there's also always the imposter syndrome of literally every album I've ever finished, I've gone, can't believe I got away with that. Right? Like, I've not got any other ideas. That's all my ideas gone. Mm-hmm. And that happened after the first record and every record. So there's a little bit of that as well of going, no, really, I'm scraping the barrel now. I yeah. don't know where you will see me came off from, but that was one of my proudest bits of writing, and that was the last track on the album. And I was like, and the last track I wrote, because the album was done at that point. And then we added
out,
that.
Mate, that's a tractor bow out.
We added that right at the end, and I was like, I don't think I'm going to get anywhere near that.
I think
again.
That's a really healthy thing, though. To that imposter syndrome, I think is healthy. I think it's, and I do think coming from sort of the areas and backgrounds that we come from, we always, I think, feel like this could all end now. And then it's like back to a factory, or, you know, back to a, you know, a 9 to 5 that, you know, I don't really want to do.
Back to HMV. It was always back to HMV in my head. That was always the, it's going to happen.
So, I mean, you talked about that being the last track. I want to now, I mean, before we get on to the last ever show and things like that, did Dan ever talk to you about plans, you know, when you've made the decision that that was going to be it and you're going to do these last, you know, last show and stuff? And did Dan ever talk about his plans to you post Dan versus Pip?
Not massively. I think it's said he still plans to make stuff and do stuff. Again, even though, as I said, I think the third album was our best artistically, at points our best personally, on the making of it, at least, the last tour or so, Dan was in a bad place, I think, and there were some points where it was uncomfortable. But again, it wasn't unbearable. It wasn't anything, you know, outrageous. Again, I've not got any crazy stories. I wish I did. I'd share them. But it felt like that was a real strong point. But I also felt that Dan still felt that he wanted to do stuff that wasn't under the shadow of me, kind of thing, or stuck to his the lyric guy. I guess that was it felt like he needed to go and do more stuff. And he's done, again, since then, he's done loads of amazing stuff. He's talked about doing stuff under another name purely for that, so he can have his stuff that's not got me on judged for him, rather than people always going, oh, you should get Pip on this, or are you going to do any more stuff with Pip? And again, we've both had that, as we've talked about and joked about a load in the past. I could post that I've won an Oscar, and people would be like, oh, you didn't, Dan doing anything soon. So again, that's kind of what we're, but again, it's a beautiful thing as well, man. I think we've both had our ups and downs on that, on feeling that that's a great thing and feeling that that's a massive weight around our necks, kind of thing. But yeah.
Talk me through both moments, both just before you walk out on stage for the last ever gig.
Yeah.
And then when you walk off stage after the last ever gig.
I mean, they were both, it was just hugely emotional. It was announced as our last ever gig. It was at Best of All. Rob the Bank was going to introduce us. So before we're going out, it's his festival. He's there. He's Rob. He's been there from the early days. And yeah, it's mad. It's really emotional. It felt great though, because it felt like a choice. I love the fact that we knew everyone knew what the deal was there. Mm-hmm. It's not this, oh, it turns out that was our last gig. Everyone in the crowd knew, or a lot of them anyway. Yeah. So yeah, and then Rob goes out, obviously gets a huge reaction. It's his festival. Mm-hmm. And he introduces us and we got a massive reaction. And then we played a gig that was the easiest gig you'll ever play, because everyone's so on board. Yeah. Like, it's like, this is a breeze. And we'd been doing it a long time then. We knew all the songs so well. It's like, this is easy. And then coming off stage, I'm starting to feel emotional now, but my favourite thing on our gigs, regardless of the, oh, I get to do a spoken word piece and everyone thinks I'm so deep, or more, it was often if I've got bits I've written in that are fast raps or intricate, nailing them felt good, because I felt like I'd proved myself as an MC. My favourite bit of almost every gig was coming off stage at the end, when Dan does the cut up of Letter from God to Man. We'd always end on Letter from God to Man, and the live version at that point, he was going into like a Prodigy track. He was going into so much stuff. And my favorite bit was always a deep breath of relief. I didn't fuck anything up.
Yeah.
It's all happened. It worked. It's over. I can relax. I'm kind of out of view, so I don't have to feel conscious anymore of, oh, I've got spit in my beard or whatever else. And I could just enjoy just watching Dan cut it up and watching the crowd just go absolutely nuts. Because that cut up, I said, like, you've seen it numerous times.
Yeah, of course.
It's fucking amazing. I've never seen it not go off.
Yeah.
So on the last one, man, that was just to come off. Again, also have that feeling of pride. It's like, well, of course, we've done that and they've all loved it.
Yeah.
But then to stand there and watch Dan just doing his thing. And again, him doing that as well, there's something, you never see him more relaxed or happy or himself, you know yeah. what I mean? Like hunched over and his yeah. feet are going, he's having a dance as well, he's showboating it. It's glorious. As yeah, that initial bit of like, wow. And then the backstage was, you know, predictably awkward of two blokes going, cool, that was cool, wasn't it? And not wanting to get over emotional, not knowing how to express things.
Yeah.
As said, also, there was a few months on, but this was off the back of a tough tour where
yeah.
I'd stopped drinking completely.
Yeah.
And Dan hadn't.
Yeah.
So just even if you're the best friends in the world, that's going to be a weird
course.
Balance, you yeah. know, because I'm just back in bed every night and everyone yeah. else, everyone's a bit pissed. So yeah, it was kind of like, wow, there we go. And Rob was there and Sarah from Sunday Best and my parents were in the crowd, all that kind of thing. So yeah, it was madness. And then I had to go and host Spoken Word at the amphitheater. So literally we did all of that. And I was like, right, I'm off, lads. we've had our emotional moment. I think that helped. I think it helped having something else to go and do. So yeah. it wasn't just this kind yeah. of weird, shit, it's over.
Yeah.
It was straight on to the next thing as such.
I mean, you've always been massively, from where I see it, massively supportive of everything Dan's done during yeah. and since Dan versus Pip as well.
Yeah.
What changes have you noticed?
Before as well, prior.
Yeah, you said you were a fan, you know?
Because that was the thing. That was one of the best things of ending our career was I can go back to just being a Dan Lesak fan. I don't have to be part of it or feeling like I'm infringing on it or, do you know what I mean?
That's kind of where I want to sort of start to wrap it up then, because like, you know, what changes have you noticed in your friendship since wrapping up the band, not having those pressures of working together or depending on each other for anything? Like, you know, you've done bits and pieces where you've, you know, reissued records and things like that collectively. And like, you know, how's yours and Dan's sort of friendship now without all of the kind of stresses of touring and all of that?
I literally spoke to him yesterday because of a project we're working on. That's yeah. not music based. Yeah. So don't, anyone listening, don't go over it. So, but yeah, it's great. I've loved getting to, as I said, return to the fan side of things. And like one of his, he did two soundtracks for Subcircular and something, I think that they had similar names, but one of them soundtracks is to these games by, I think they were Mike Biffle ones. And I remember just the, like when one of them came out, I downloaded it at Lizards.
Yeah.
It was at Lizards. It was one where I was heading off because of an acting gig, I think. So I think I had to drive to Wales. I had to do my set and then drive to Wales. And driving through London with Thunder and Lightning and Dan's Subcircular soundtrack was like, this is the best music in the world. This is the best production. And then, yeah, the more, like, I know a few things he's working on at the moment. And I chatted to him, we had a Zoom call while he was in America recently. And I came off of it beaming with pride and happiness for him because of a particular thing he's working on. Because it's like, this is literally what he was made to do. It's another computer game thing, but yeah. So I really enjoyed that. Particularly in the early days, there were some tensions because when you've been away for a little while, people will come in with big money offers for gigs. And I was done. I'm done.
Yeah.
Like, again, I'm genuinely, I talked to Polar Bear about this sometimes of when we were both shit at Spoken Word, there was no one in the crowd. And the year or so it took us to get to become good performers, the crowd grew. I've now had so long off that I would be awful live. Like we started, like we talked about that shout earlier. I couldn't even remember the line. That's like our biggest song. I've played it thousands of times.
Well, to go full circle,
I can't remember the line.
It's that whole thing, isn't it? About we gigged and gigged and gigged and we got tight. We got good.
And whereas to come back now, it's like, what are we going to do? A month of rehearsals?
Getting
match fit. It's like, nah. I can't be, I'm not, it doesn't excite me in that way. And a big thing I realised after stopping gigging that my excitement always came from showing everyone all this new stuff and what we have made together.
Yeah.
And when I stopped wanting to write or having anything I felt I wanted to write about, it was kind of like, right, I don't, like, that realisation came when other people from the label had come over. So Sage would be over. And I did some stuff with Sage. But yeah, after that, other people would be over and they'd be like, oh, do you want to come up and do a song? Oh, I want to stand here and be a fan.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
I don't
yeah.
need that pop of adrenaline of everyone going, oh my God, it's Pip. I was like, no, it's all, we've done that. So yeah, I always said I'd only come back if I did new music, and I always felt if I did new music, it'd be solo because I did two solo records mm-hmm. and three with Dan. And I like the idea of doing three and three, job done. But again, even that just drifted away. I was like, oh, I've not got any desire to.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, I'm going to finish with one more question. And looking back over your 8 years mm-hmm. as Dan versus Pip.
Mad that it was only 8 years, isn't
I know.
It? The amount that we got in there.
I know. and that's great. Yeah. I want you to tell me the best memory that, looking back on that time, that you shared with Dan.
It's tough, isn't it? I really remember playing halfway up a mountain in Japan at Fuji Rocks, which ironically isn't on Mount Fuji, it's another mountain. And at that point, like, that was still quite early on in our career, and we had like probably a 45 minutes set, and that gig made me realize how much of that relied on our chat and banter with the crowd, because we didn't have that many songs. Yeah. And we finished the first song, cheer, and I'm like, what's up? And they just kind of stared, and I'm trying to chat and have interaction. And again, not being a naturally confident person, I remember just looking around at Dan like, help me, kind of thing. And he just dropped the next beat, and that set went from 45 minutes to about 30 minutes, because I was like, you've got to save me here. Normally, I can get a lot of the gig and get a lot of that. Again, our gigs were
for
about
God's
interaction.
Sake, Dan, will you just get your dick out?
Just get it out, quick. Yeah, so I remember that really clearly, and Dan being a proper saviour there. But then, yeah, as I said, it's repeatedly, it's Letter from God to Man, headlining a stage at Glastonbury and being at the side and watching him do that. Headlining stages at Reading and Leeds, or specifically Reading, actually, because at Leeds, I dashed off to go and catch the end of Rage Against the Machine. But at Reading, again, just getting to stand back and watch that with that crowd that are so warmed up and fired up from the gig that we've done, and just watching him build and build and go on and on. Yeah, repeatedly that. Coachella, again, down inside stage, and there's like palm trees in the background, yeah. And there's this long run of people who are all going nuts for it. So yeah, it'd be a kind of a Rocky montage of Dan doing the outro of Let From God to Man in all these different locations, including, like, it meant the world to play like the Paradiso in Amsterdam, because it's like an iconic venue, and sure. Doing Coco and Shepherd's Bush Empire and places like that. And then, yeah, all the festivals. Like, there was one weird year at Bestival where we were on the main stage, and for some reason the timings just lined up that we had, Rob reckoned, at least 30,000, maybe 20, 30,000 people all there, because we were on the main stage and it happened that seemingly nothing else was on. And I remember that just being a sea of people in the daytime, and Dan just cutting it up, and everyone just, the rowdy bit at the front that's rammed, and then just as far back as you can see, people in space just having a little dance and having a little boogie. So yeah, I guess I'd go with that. Or maybe just the first time I saw his dick at the Bullseye.
Thanks, Pip. I'll tell you what, that was one of my faves, that one. It was really nice to get that little insight into what it was like, because obviously, you know, I've been around you, and I've been around you when you've been with Dan, and obviously I've done loads of bits and bobs over the years with Dan, and spoke to him extensively on other podcasts, and it was really nice to kind of get that insight into what it was like being in a duo, you know, as you mentioned at the beginning, being in a duo with someone, which is going to be intense.
Yeah.
And you know, Dan can be a very intense human being.
100%.
And as can you.
Yeah.
And so, you know, to be able to sort of handle that and deal with that and continue to sort of make it work. Yeah, it was really interesting to sort of find out how that works.
My favourite part of reliving all of that was remembering the period that I became a Dan Lesac fan. Like, I was, before we even worked together, really, he, as is all we've just discussed, but his Lesac Say Yeah album, I loved it. And then to come to the kind of the period now where I get to go back to being just a Dan Lesac fan rather than a collaborator anymore. And that's the beautiful part of the journey there for me, is that whole bit in the middle that he facilitated and was instrumental in some of my favourite memories that I'll ever have. But then also it's nice to have this kind of, that either side thing of that all happened, and now I get to go back to just watching at a distance and going, fucking hell, he's good.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Well, we'll be back, obviously, next week. Next week's episode is playing live. So Dan Lissack will come up a bit in that, but there'll also be a... I mean, you were reveling in some of the stories of early bands and stuff that I had, because you had no idea.
Yeah, that all sounded truly dreadful as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, very much so. So, yeah, we'll be getting into that next week.
Absolutely. We'll see you next time.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.